started, we've got three good topics for this afternoon. First up, we have Future of Sustainability in Rochester. And Allie and Matus?
Yes, sir.
We're going to lead us through this, so I will turn it over to the two of you and have at it.
Thank you very much, sir. So good afternoon, everyone, Mayor, City Council members, and citizens of Rochester. First of all, thank you very much for having us and finding the time for us this afternoon. So today we are going to continue and add on to the conversation that you heard a few weeks ago about the Energy Action Plan and the city's greenhouse gas inventory. So my name is Matus Miron. I'm currently studying for a master's in global energy policy and finance at Columbia. And my project this summer focuses on next steps for the Energy Action Plan and sustainability in Rochester overall.
I'm Allie Anderson. I'm at USC's Marshall Business School, getting a master's in social enterprise with emphasis in sustainable business. And we're here today through the EDF Climate Corps program. So the Environmental Defense Fund each summer hires about 100 grad students and deploys us to different organizations across the country to work on the sustainability project. So we are here under that program, but funded through the McKnight Foundation.
And today we're going to have a quick look into sustainability, what it is, what it means, so that when we throw this word around, so that you understand, so that we have sort of an understanding of what it means in general. We're going to quickly look at the current state of sustainability in Rochester. We're going to go through our projects briefly, and together we're going to make a case for hiring a sustainability coordinator as part of the sustainability office here in Rochester. So, sustainability is definitely a buzzword, and people imagine different things under this word. So when we say sustainability, we would like you to imagine measures in electricity, generation, distribution, consumption, the same for gas, or projects, for example, that affect buildings and their energy consumption, for example, or projects that have to do with recycling, or transportation, or waste management. Basically, these are measures that have economic, environmental, or social goals or impact, such as reducing energy bills for city operations, or whether it's fueling economic growth in the community, or it's reducing air pollution, or increasing economic equality among the citizens. All of these, when we say sustainability, it can be one or all or some of these. So all the way below, that's our favorite quote about sustainability, or favorite definition, which is that it is a deliberate effort to ensure that community development not only enhances the local economy, but also the local environment and quality of life. So
why we're here to talk about sustainability in Rochester, obviously the economic case kind of speaks for itself. There's a large amount of savings to be had through energy efficiency projects. There's also the potential for revenue growth from new business in communities that are very forward-thinking sustainability. We've seen this in Dubuque, where IBM cited one of the reasons they went to Dubuque, Iowa, is because of their advanced sustainability program, and it's really attracting the type of employees that they're looking for. It's going to attract and retain that top talent. Environmentally, it's a national and global trend. It creates a more vibrant, livable community. Locally, you guys are in kind of a nexus of DMC planning, the comprehensive plan, and a major growth trajectory, so this is a great time to start thinking seriously about how sustainability goes into all of those pieces. And then, briefly, you adopted Ordinance 19A, which speaks to the city's goals for sustainability. So, as I mentioned, goals have definitely been set here at Rochester. You've adopted the Minnesota Next Gen Energy Action Goals. The first two bullets are already well underway. The third one, as you heard a couple weeks ago, just had your first greenhouse gas inventory completed. So no real progress has yet been made on those greenhouse gas emission reductions yet, as you didn't have anything to benchmark against until last week. There's also the 2015 proclamation of striving for that 100% renewable by 2031. So progress has definitely been made on those goals. The Energy Commission was put into place. It's been included in planning with the COMP and the DMC. RPU has done several programs around sustainability and energy efficiency. You're members of the B3 benchmarking, which is a Minnesota mandate that tracks your building's energy consumption at the city level. And then there's obviously energy efficiency projects that have been underway. But all the pieces are here. What we think is really lacking is just the coordination and commitment to move these things forward now.
Yeah, so we believe that the city lacks the ability to execute a lot of its goals, which is predominantly due to a lack of dedicated city personnel. operations, so city buildings, for example, or whether it has to do with communicating with the community and with your citizens on what they can do to reduce their bills or what they can do to reduce their environmental impact. And another gap is, as Ali mentioned, the fact that until recently, Rochester did not have the greenhouse gas inventory, so obviously it did not really progress towards any goals there. Another issue is the fact that when we were looking at the Energy Action Plan and the priority projects that are listed or highlighted in the Energy Action Plan, once again, the issue was who is going to implement it or who is going to do it, and there is simply just no one for a majority of the projects. And another issue slash opportunity is the fact that Rochester has a very vibrant community. There are a lot of stakeholders who deal with environmental issues or energy issues, and we met with a lot of them, and that's great. The only issue is that, unlike in other cities, oftentimes these community organizations, they bond together, and they'll create something like Sustainable Rochester or something like that, which gives them a little bit more power, whether it's financial power, whether it's targeting power in terms of the people they have on their mailing list. They simply can reach wider audience. So there's definitely another possibility for improvement. So I was trying to assess the implementation of the Energy Action Plan in my during my project and the city's long-term strategy. And I was simply trying to figure out how the city can move forward. A way that will ensure continuous progress in the area of sustainability, one that will gain credibility among city departments, and one that will allow further engagement with the residential, industrial, commercial community. So, and Ali.
Yep, so we each had individual projects that we were working on throughout the summer. So like Matush mentioned, his is more the long-term planning and strategy. Mine was looking a little bit more internally at the city operations. So the goal for my summer project was really to reduce total energy consumption and spend at municipal properties. And adopt sustainable practices throughout. So identifying those cost-saving measures as well as finding funding opportunities to push those forward. And what came of our two individual projects is the identification that there really needs to be a coordinator to help move a lot of this forward. So together we built the economic and environmental case for this position, that project management position and implementation. So here's a snapshot, current state of where Rochester is at. So I'm not sure if you are all familiar with the B3 benchmarking platform, but like I mentioned, it's a Minnesota mandate. And you're currently tracking 17 buildings totaling 1.8 million square feet. So this is a really great tool to let you dive into energy usage and spend at the building level as well as at the city level and be able to benchmark against other Minnesota communities to get an idea of where you are, kind of lay of the land. So as you can see, you're at just under 3 stars, 5-star being the best, compared to other Minnesota communities. And you're just an idea to how large the scope is. Annual energy spend at the city is over $4 million, $1.2 million in demand charges on top of that. And then an annual energy consumption of 200,000 kBTUs. So within your own internal city operation, there's a large opportunity here with both energy consumption and spend. Just a further slide showing that energy usage is definitely downtrending, but marginally. Based on the goals that have been set by the city, we would want to see these lines with a much more strong downward trajectory year over year. So again, my project was internally facing. The three major areas of opportunity that I identified were energy efficiency opportunities, a measurement and verification process for the city to use, as well as future planning and funding. So I'm going to walk through those and how a sustainability coordinator would help you manage all of these issues. So energy efficiency is truly the easiest way to reduce energy while receiving financial benefit. There's been a number of one-off projects that have been completed by the city dating back from 06 with the junk control project that you may be familiar with. So there's a summary of that that will be sent out after. But the major opportunity identified here was really that through these energy efficiency projects, there hasn't been a consistent recommissioning of the buildings that the city owns, which leaves a lot of opportunity on the table. And then the other major energy identification was the fact that there could be a much more aggressive LED streetlight conversion plan underway. So a little bit more into those projects. Recommissioning, your buildings, it's pretty nominal upfront fee, but you can see 10 to 15% improvement in efficiencies. So when you're talking about a $4 million energy spend on your buildings, that 10 to 15% can become pretty large if this is planned out appropriately. So we had a third party come in and analyze two facilities. Their estimate was that there was about $53,000 in annual savings available just in these two facilities identified. And with streetlights, currently only 11% of the city's streetlights have been converted to LED. And they're right now being converted at about 100 per year. Granted, that number will grow as more of the metal halide and vapor lights go out, but based on the current trajectory, you're about 75 years out from full implementation. So switching to LED would save 2.4 million kilowatt hours a year, which is an energy savings of $360,000 per year based on 2016 rates. So really large opportunity there. This is where, in doing research of other communities, most have seen a really great success with LED streetlight conversion. So it's definitely top of list for an energy efficiency project. This goes into a little bit more detail on projected costs, rebates, and annual savings for the projects identified. And this will again be sent out for you to view earlier or at a later date. But between the three projects identified, it's about a $2.5 million cost with an annual savings of $420,000 per year. So, second piece is measurement reporting. So it's really, you cannot manage what you do not measure is kind of the catchphrase when it comes to these type of projects. Currently the city doesn't have a process to measure and verify projects that they have completed in terms of energy efficiency. Each project is kind of handled as a one-off case, depends on which department ran it, which consulting company it was done through. So it's really recommended that the utilization of the V3 data, the data is out there and it's available for use. I just don't think a lot of eyes are on it right now or utilizing the data that you already have. And then there's also opportunity to get into some programs that are made for nonprofits and city governments, which help really track the financial and energy savings at a much more granular level. That helps with planning, it helps with proving out the benefit of these type of projects, and it just helps to create best practices and design guidelines going forward so that you're not constantly recreating the wheel each time you do a new project. And then the last chunk of my project was around planning and funding. So really, there needs to be short and long-term plans for energy management as well as sustainability goals. Like I mentioned, you guys are at a really great spot with the comprehensive plan, DMC, the 2040 growth that's expected. It's a really good opportunity right now to start thinking about how Rochester wants to position themselves in terms of energy usage and sustainability. So this coordinator's role would really be to coordinate, strategize, monitor, measure, and execute on all of these areas of impact. With that becomes funding. So there's a huge opportunity for funding with energy efficiency and sustainability projects right now. There's grants and then rebates and incentives, but again, it takes someone who knows how to go through the grant process. It takes someone who has the dedicated time and expertise to go through and fill out these forms, identify the opportunities that Rochester has. I threw together just a list of grants that are available that Rochester would qualify for. A lot of these obviously would be due in the fall. Just kind of giving a snapshot of the impact that this coordinator could have, not only in terms of saving the city money within their own operations, but also out there seeking more additional funding, which would be a major benefit. And then lastly, with funding, we wanted to present to you the idea of having a green revolving fund. So as I mentioned, you guys have had a lot of projects go through that were energy efficiency projects that have had a large dollar savings. However, that money just kind of dissipates back into the general fund. It doesn't get tracked or funneled. So the idea of a green revolving fund is that you use a portion of those energy savings and put it back into a fund, which then finances more energy efficiency and sustainability projects going forward. So each year it isn't an ask of the budget. It becomes just kind of a revolving door of money that helps to finance a lot of these projects. Again, this is a great place where the sustainability coordinator would manage that. It started at the university level, but it's gaining a lot of traction in cities. Duluth has one, Asheville, North Carolina has one, Dubuque, Iowa is setting one up as well. And it just has really education that I've researched and seen. So just another thought on the funding piece to help move forward a lot of these projects. So here is a list of many of the communities in the state that have a sustainability officer. Matush and I did interviews with several of them, just getting an idea of how their office is set up, what projects they take on, when they were founded, that type of thing. So we just wanted to give a snapshot of the sustainability office is alive and working very well in a lot of communities. There's a huge peer network available that would help get this up and running in the city. So with that, kind of what we've gathered from a lot of our interviews with coordinators across the state and country is just the benefit of having someone focused on energy management and sustainability. They provide a holistic management of the projects that I mentioned previously. They connect teams and departments and help identify synergies. A really great example of this is St. Paul put in the light rail. Rather than just looking at it as transportation, they took it upon themselves to think about how that could then benefit their stormwater system. And then took it one step further with forestry coming in and saying, well, actually, this is an opportunity for green canopy and a way to reduce urban heat island effect. So one project pairs off with many different departments, creating a more holistic, more beneficial project in the end. Again, the coordinator would manage funding and financing. It provides you in-house expertise and able to advise different departments on making informed decisions rather than having to contract that out oftentimes. And it becomes a point person for concerned parties. So it's a point person for the Rochester Energy Commission. It's a point person for community groups. It's a point person for the DMC Energy Integration Committee. The DMC plan has a lot of asks of the city. If you look through their energy and sustainability project, this gives you a person who is able to manage a lot of that.
And so in addition, there are other benefits, which include, for example, information management, whether that's between city departments, that oftentimes there are grants or initiatives for the city that are being sent around on emails, like on email chat between employees and the city. As opposed to doing that, the sustainability coordinator could simply put them into a database, or whether it's networking with other sustainability coordinators. Because I can speak from our experience when we talk to Dubuque, when we talk to Duluth, when we talk to Asheville, we learned so much from a 25-minute call. So if they were able to develop actual relationships with people who have been doing that specific job in other cities for some places 5 years, other places already 10 years, the benefits and the upside is enormous. Then Ali mentioned previously as well, but the ability to define and secure external funding, whether it's local, state, federal grants, or even from foundations, for example, like the McNaught Foundation. And then also securing these different kinds of grants and funding that can then lead to execution of projects that they have money for. So not everything has to simply come from city budget or from the Green Revolving Fund. If there's a project, it might be an interesting project that they get a grant for, and they can execute it, which right now is impossible. And in addition, the sustainable coordinator would be able to manage Rochester's participation in different initiatives, such as Green Step, which Rochester is already part of, or for example, SoulSmart, that is seeking to reduce sort of soft costs of solar panel installation on in residential areas, which means sort of barriers that city might have, whether it's an ordinance or whether it's a practice, and any benefits that might stem from that. And then lastly, it's the coordinator would be able to conduct outreach and communications to the community primarily, which right now is not happening because Rochester does not have a communications department at all, so it's just sort of dead. So we envision this office to gradually evolve. We would like, ideally, three phases. The first phase will focus on projects that Ali mentioned, which include energy efficiency, retro-commissioning of city buildings, so primarily city operations. The second phase will slightly expand on this work, and so it will focus a little bit more messaging to the community and community projects. And the third phase will go even beyond that, and it's going to explore an idea of resiliency, which we'll get into further. But I would just like to clarify that these phases, the three, they're not mutually exclusive. So they're going to overlap. So by the time that there's phase three, it's sustainably Cardinal will still be doing city operations focused projects. It's just that at the beginning, it makes sense to probably focus on city operations while you can sort of diversify later on. So the phase one, as we mentioned, energy efficiency projects, city operations projects, the buzzword of low-hanging fruit, it's all there. Ali identified some of the projects, and I'm pretty sure there are plenty more. Another objective is to imbue sustainability into the city departments, their thinking and decision-making, so that maybe in a few years when someone is pursuing some sort of a project in a specific department, they will by themselves think of the energy implications, even if it might be tangential to their primary work. During this phase, they will already begin what I mentioned previously, which is information management or participation in different initiatives or gathering community input, but it will be on the smaller scale, so let's say 10, 15, 20% of their work. The sustainability coordinator's role and his sort of time and how he allots it will very much depend on external funding, on government and community support, and on what the other stakeholders and partners are doing. Because, as I mentioned before, if there's a project that the sustainability coordinator, the office, or the city can get a grant for, then maybe 30% of his time will be devoted to that. If there's nothing like that, then maybe he will simply focus on city operations. And this will vary between the different phases. So the second phase gets a little bit more interesting because they're all continuous diversifying. So again, we're continuing with the city operations, but based on the funding, based on personnel, he might have some additional personnel, based on direction from the Rochester Energy Commission or from community groups, he might do different projects. So these might include, these are just random ideas that I had yesterday last night. So for example, it can be a pilot neighborhood awareness energy conservation campaign through the neighborhood association. You know, that's the way to do it. They are going to do a pilot. If it works, they can measure whether it worked, what were the consequences. If it works, they can continue on to other neighborhoods. If, for example, the Sustainable Development Office would be able to get a Minnesota Green Corps member, which is pretty much one staff for free for a year, who, for example, has experience with small-scale commercial energy efficiency programs, they can focus on that. They can go to small shops around Rochester, maybe shops that RPU does not necessarily have, not interest, but it's not as much in their interest to reach them as it is with larger consumers of energy. And so they can go to them, again, with an Excel sheet and with what things to do, how they can improve, how they can reduce their bills. Or it can be Mayo, for example, they're also developing their sustainability program. And we believe that they're going to hire someone soon as well. And they're most likely going to do behavior change programs on their employees. So suddenly, if a few Mayo doctors in a few neighborhoods suddenly are aware and they're educated about energy issues by Mayo already, then the coordinator can simply sort of use them as nodes within the community and sort of just tack on Mayo's efforts. So whatever it is, whatever is going to happen, it just allows us to do something. And then lastly, he will be able to update the greenhouse gas inventory, which should probably be updated every 3 years, ideally. So, and the third phase gets very broad, and it looks very much beyond and just environmental sustainability. And it includes subjects such as built environment, social equity, economic growth, transportation, health and well-being, adaptability or resiliency. Every city pursues this or describes it differently. So phase three is focused and based on ideas and principles. And cities oftentimes develop these ideas and principles to sort of help guide them through decision-making and planning. And they often touch upon the three circles that we have there, the economic, the environmental, and the social causes. So some cities, for example, they do develop a vision that is based on these three, and when they intersect, and they figure out words that you know that mean that specific intersection between them. So it can be viability, livability, or equity, for example. And we stole these from, I believe, Dubuque. But then develop goals and indicators on how to achieve these principles so that they can put some things in action. And then they have strategies and implementation plans, which is the normal course of action. And I completely agree that this is how things are done. But Rochester is slightly different. So as every city is different, some cities decide to first focus on ideas and principles and simply let it trickle down. We believe that in Rochester's case, given the constrained resources and given what we learned from our 10 weeks here, we would leave the planning and sort of the phase three ideas and principles for later, which is 5 to 8 years, and start with the energy management position in the city operations that would be titled sustainability coordinator, but that would evolve possibly into this later on.
So kind of in conclusion of what we've thought through for how this coordinator position could be funded, and we've listed out risks and benefits of each. This kind of goes in order of what we would recommend. So there's the option of going third party and seeking consulting services. We don't think that this is a great option because it's very expensive. It's going to really lack in that cohesive long-term strategy that we think the city really needs. Another option is to use your current staff. You could make sustainability kind of an initiative that each department participates in. You obviously wouldn't be adding any headcount, but you would be adding quite a bit of responsibility. We think that the risk here is really that you're going to lack the resource, the expertise, and the time to execute on the projects presented here to make them meaningful and actually really impactful. Another option is to explore an extension program with the University of Minnesota. This leads to some benefits with the network that you would be able to tap into with that program. But it does lack the connectivity to the city, and there's obviously the risk of competing priorities. There's the option of temporary staff. We mentioned Minnesota Green Corps, the Mid-AmeriCorps program. Someone comes in for a year or two. It's temporary, and there's a minimal financial impact, but it's usually reliant on third-party funding, and the scope can be very restricted based on that individual's previous experience. You don't have a lot of say in what you would get here. There's cities that do it, but it's not ideal for your main point person. It's great as supplemental staff. We really think the benefit is in the full-time staff person. It's a point person for the Rochester Energy Commission, as we mentioned. You're able to influence the city operations much more in-depthly. It really signals your commitment to sustainability as a community. And obviously, we've talked through a lot of the energy savings opportunity and funding opportunities that are out there. We think that this person, in theory, could fund their own salary through not only grants. Many cities fund this position 10 to 15% through grants each year, as well as just through, again, the utility savings that are available if you were to more aggressively pursue some of these energy efficiency projects. So we wanted to lay out all of the different ways in which this may come to fruition, but we really feel strongly that full-time staff is going to be your best opportunity to execute on a lot of this. And there's always an option, too, of working through general funds or through RPU as a funding source. We see that in communities across the state. Duluth was kind of the main example of their local utility, their municipal utility, similar structure to Rochester. Some of the funding for this position comes out of that, especially if it's very energy management focused in the first few years. So this is just kind of a summary of our findings, where we find opportunities to be. Just kind of wanted to leave you with an idea of the scope in which this person's work would include. Quite broad. There's a lot of great opportunity to save energy, to save money, to demonstrate your commitment, the financing options that are there, the funding that's there. And really, it's just you don't want to be lagging behind local, national, and international communities who have really had about a decade of time and energy invested into this already. So there's a great network and opportunity to join that network and have that peer peer advising for this position. So really, in conclusion, we think that hiring a sustainability coordinator allows you to hit on a majority of these buckets.
All right. Excellent report. Very comprehensive. I'll open it up to the council for other questions or comments. Mr. Woodyer.
Well, there's a decision point here. Is this something we pursue or something we don't pursue? And I'd like to see this part of our 2017 strategy.
Mr. Ruska.
I see Dale in the audience. Dale, could you give us an update on Johnson Control and where we are with that contract? Is that still being paid on, or is that about done?
I think 2018 is the last payment.
And it would seem that some of these things are identified here as things that Johnson Control should be and should have been doing. Are they? Is this part of it at all? Or
they did at the time. That contract is done from the standpoint of they haven't really come back other than our maintenance contracts that we wrote with them on the different facilities that they did at the time. And we did some measurement verification, I think it was a year after, whatever. You may recall Mike Smith came along and did a report to you on all the different facilities. The problem that happens after that is there's so much of the uses that change, there's additions that happen, there's things that change throughout it, so it's a little bit hard to go back and say, okay, is this particular savings that was originally projected there or not? But, and again, those projects strictly on the actual assets that were purchased, you know, they get paid off about the time they wear out. You know, it's time to start talking about it again, not before. So I have a little thoughts about it. Shut up.
Well, what was the, my final question, what was the amount that we're paying them annually on that? Do you remember?
I don't remember. It was a $6.5 million, $6.2 million, something like that, was the total project. And, I don't know what the payments are. They're split across all the different departments that actually have to do them.
Ballpark?
Okay. I have a summary of that. That will be in the final report of the Johnson Control project.
Okay. Yeah, well, if she's got it covered, that's fine. It would just seem to me that as that resolves and we're no longer paying that, that would certainly open up some funding for this position.
Well, I mean, that's okay. But that's exactly what's happening in the rec center. You know, recall, we just are starting the next phase of the one for the rec center, which part of the savings that they're taking. Dropping off, they're basically trying to not impact the budget and move forward on the next phase of the center. I think if you go back to Richard's and my discussion with that, I think we really need a facility coordinator first that then has somebody like this report to them and works through all these different things. Until you get somebody who focuses it on across the whole city, it's really hard on an individual basis to get each department who has one of these facilities is focusing on providing services. At the moment, they may not have time to think about their energy thing, but if you had somebody thinking about how you could coordinate across the whole organization, it's a whole focus.
I think that was definitely our finding as well, that this, the energy piece is always an add-on or an afterthought or a, you know, in addition to someone's core role responsibilities. So the idea of having someone who's dedicated to this, who has the expertise in this, and who can help really, you know, wade through a lot of these projects is, has huge benefit.
And just a final question then, Stephen, would that fall under Public Works or what department would, if that position was to move forward, what, where would that?
The facilities manager?
The sustainability coordinator.
I'm not sure yet.
I think it would.
I don't know that we've had that discussion. I think there's several opportunities of where it could be.
Okay. Mr. Campion?
I guess I would caution us to try and fit it under an existing department and maybe consider federating it from other operations in the city, because I think one of the things that I think is most compelling about this argument here is the idea of a rotating fund where you incentivize the group that we can tackle more of these things if we can build the capacity through realizing savings and being able to take it, compartmentalize it, and analyze it standalone. It's fundamental. I mean, it's paramount that we don't get it lost in a I forget the total cost of Richard's oversight, but you know, when we get up that with that significant of a budget, it's easy to lose a couple $100,000. As sad as that sounds, it's, you know, it gets kind of leveled off over a bunch of organizations. So I think that focus on that recurring revenue and the ability to leverage savings toward the future, even if we have to peel off some of the stuff we're already doing and recategorize it into this account, I think that's perfectly valid. If we're making efforts already, moving them under an umbrella called sustainability and having a sustainability department that does this, I think that's a great idea. So I guess I would caution the council while trying to fit it into an existing department.
That would be our recommendation as well, is that we wouldn't want it housed within a department.
What a great recommendation.
Yes.
Mr. Zicki, then Mr. Wojak.
So what, I mean, so when I think of energy, I think of RPU. So what efforts do they have at RPU? I mean, you would think there was someone who at least has this as part of their additional roles and responsibilities. You know, LED streetlights, I mean, that's low-hanging fruit. So I imagine they've done an analysis on this and came up with their plan. What's the background on that?
The impression that I got on the streetlight-specific portion of RPU is that there hasn't been the question raised or the concern about the fact that this hasn't gone as quickly. There's also the piece of depreciated assets, so that hasn't been factored into the calculation because I can't get an answer from the finance department up there for how much depreciated asset is left on these streetlights. So that is what's stalling it to a degree, is you would have to pay off that depreciated asset to then move to LED, but I don't know how big that number is because I wasn't able to secure that information. So that's what I can say about the streetlights specifically.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a follow-up? Because I had do you have that chart? Can you go back to that chart that listed the streetlight as the top one? Because the numbers didn't quite make sense to me.
This was based off, so Lumio is a company that does energy as a service, or lighting as a service, I'm sorry.
I'm just wondering how, with a total project cost of $2.3 million and an annual savings of $0.36 million, we get a four-year payoff.
That was based on, so they offer lighting as a service. So the way that it would be contract structured,
okay.
He presented it as a four-year
payoff. Oh, okay. Sorry. Now I follow. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Wagner.
But again, that 2.35 doesn't count for your depreciated assets.
I would also second the notion that putting this into one of the department silos would not be the appropriate way to go. If anywhere, it would probably be the administrator's office, so there's access to all the departments, because the, you know, the word coordinator in it implies that it's working with all these groups. And I think that the afterthought is something that I'll hammer on again and again and again. If you remember the rec center project, when the budget got cut, there was absolutely no discussion of doing any energy savings whatsoever. It was build as much space as possible, and only after the fact did we go back and use the Guaranteed Energy Savings Program to fund that. Simultaneously, we just had the discussion with the airport. We brought up, with regards to what we're looking to do down there. I asked the question, hey, this is one of the worst performing buildings in the state of Minnesota, and nobody had any analysis of what was being done energy-wise to address that down there. It just speaks to that ongoing lack of focus. RPU has certain mandates in terms of what they're trying to do on conservation, but you have to remember, RPU is only about one-third of the energy in the community. There's two-thirds that they don't touch at all, and that includes the transportation energy and the heating energy in the community. So this is far greater than just RPU. Now, on the electrical side, RPU would certainly play a role in it, but I think the opportunities that are lost here is time and time again, a project comes to us in such a mature form that we don't necessarily have the opportunity at that point to design with energy or conservation in mind at that point. And this is where I see the great opportunity of this position.
All right. Other questions, comments?
I just have a comment. I thought it was an excellent presentation. We don't often think about it that it's not always in the forefront, and it probably should be, because it does help economically, as we have other needs within the city that need funding, and this revolving fund is a super cool idea, I think. And I don't know if that, if we had anything like that in the past, but this should be integrated into the a planning process into 2017. I absolutely agree with that. I'm kind of curious about Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth, and they all have sustainability coordinators now.
Yes.
And how long have they been in place?
About a decade. A lot of them came 05 to 07 was the time frame where a lot of communities started ramping up, putting these offices in place. And like we said, we talked to a lot of communities, and the way in which the office is structured varies greatly depending on the community's needs. But at the end of the week, this is our last week, I'll be leaving you with a lot of case studies and a lot of more, far more in-depth information about the revolving fund, ways to get that set up and financed, different ways in which the office could be structured, that type of thing.
I had another question, just for clarification. You talked about the LED streetlights and it's 11% replacement in the city?
100% have been converted so far.
Converted. And
yeah.
So, and that equated to about 350,000.
If you were to do all of it.
All of them.
If you were to convert all of your streetlights to LED right now, yes, there would be 360,000 in annual energy savings based on your 2016 rates.
Thank you.
Then, with the streetlights, having seen this happen, the general rule is that they're not actually replacing the lights when the lights burn out. They're doing it when the full ballast burns out. And I think there's an accounting reason to do that, but I don't think there's a good financial reason to do that, because honestly, the labor to switch out these lights is much greater than the energy consumed.
It's about, you cut your labor cost by 80%.
So it's just a policy, and I've asked for some reports from RPO on the analysis of this, and we just haven't gotten them back yet. But based on their work, I imagine they came up with the correct financial solution to that as well. When do you expect your report to be fully available?
It'll be completed Friday.
And then if we're going to integrate this into our thinking for 2017, Stephen, what is the decision points, the tree to make that decision?
We have to set the maximum property tax levy on the 15th of September. Mm-hmm. And then prepare the budget for the next couple of months and decide what you fit into that amount of money.
Okay. All right. So it sounds like this could come forward potentially as an idea for 2017 in terms of staffing. Let's see how it works. Thank you very much for a very good report. All right, we'll move on to our next topic.
Yeah, if I could, I'd like to introduce Professor Jim Wild here. He's a faculty member over at the University of Minnesota, Mankato, and the public program right there in Suspect. And he was commissioned by the Minnesota local Rural Research Board a few years ago to do a study on the effects of heavy equipment, heavy vehicles on Minnesota roads. We asked him if he would consider doing a similar type of study specifically for Rochester, the effect of heavy vehicles on Rochester roads using Rochester data. And graciously, he's done that. I think the final report that he has provided was part of your package here. So.
Well, thank you for having me come down here and talk about this very exciting topic of the deterioration and heavy loads. And I know that from work of Richard, Doug, and Russ, they agree with me that it's a very exciting topic.
I agree with you. It's fabulous.
Thank you. I'm teaching a class in the spring on pavement design and deterioration.
It's available online. I wouldn't want to deteriorate the pavement between here and Mankato.
In your heavy truck?
That's right.
Well, I thought I'd start a little bit with a little bit of the background of what you have in the report and talk about just a little bit of the background of pavement deterioration and heavy vehicles and what we see there. And then talk about the specifics of what I work on with the department. So this is the a typical pavement deterioration curve or performance curve. If we just look at this just quickly, if we assume that a new road starts out at a pavement condition index of 100, and over time as vehicles drive on it and the environment, the climate, you know, the changing temperatures throughout the seasons, that has an impact on it also. Over time, it declines. We have some minimum acceptable condition, which would be set by policy, whether by the Public Works Department or the council. And it could look like this, depending on how much the road is used, how many heavy trucks, how heavy they are. And most commonly, it's somewhere in the middle. And the timeline on here doesn't mean a whole lot because it depends on the heavy trucks that it sees, how it's constructed, how thick it's constructed, and the material that's made. But this is just these first few slides are a general concept. So I'm going to go to the next one. In general, though, no matter how you draw that curve, about the first half of the decline in from 100% down to this minimum condition, that first half of the decline usually takes around 80% of the time for the traffic that's applied to it, and then the other half takes only about 20%, so it really declines pretty quickly. And this curve is just a typical, I've continued this, it may even be steeper than this. It doesn't really get too vertical, but it really declines quickly at the end. So one common thing that we see in pavement management terms is if you spend a dollar, you could spend a dollar on maintaining the pavement here at this level, around 80 or above, or 70 or above, or it could be anywhere from, I've seen some numbers between $6 and $23 to get the same impact once you wait until it's down here. So I didn't include a slide on this, but increasing from here back up as you add capacity or structural, the structure to the pavement, it could be, or maintaining that could be pretty cheap, but waiting just a little bit longer can be very expensive. And so these numbers, the 6 to 23, California Pavement Maintenance Corporation says it could be between $6 and $8. Massachusetts Municipal Association said between $8 and $10. And you can see Washington City DOT, $9 to $14. And one, I don't know why, the city of North Castle, New York, decided they'd publish between $18 and $23. They said $1 here could be about $18 to $23, cost you $18 to $23 later, just to get the road condition back up. So just a basic idea about vehicle loads, how they're not, obviously, whether it's a car, a delivery truck, or a semi, that little car like that might have 1,000-pound axles. And on two tires on each axle, that's 500 pounds. The minivan that we drive probably has 2,000 pounds on each axle. Pickup truck would be maybe 4,000 pounds or 3,500 in the front and 2,500 pounds in the back. And then you can see these, a common semi, you can see, consider about 12,000 pounds on the steering axle and sharing 34,000 pounds each on the heavy axle. So, one last thing about pavement deterioration, though, is the damage that's done by the road, or by the trucks, or the load, any kind of load. The damage that's done is not linear, but it's about a fourth power relationship. So what that means is, if you double the load, say a 10,000-pound axle to a 20,000-pound axle, or what we have, what you see in the report is this term, an ESO, or an equivalent single axle load, and that's set at an 18,000-pound single axle load, 9,000 pounds on each tire. That's set at a relative damage of 1 if you go across to see the 1 there. And then if you double it, the damage increases by about 16 times. So it's 2, doubling 2 to the 4th power. So if you see the 18,000 pounds, if you double that to 36,000 pounds, the relative damage is around 16. That's not an absolute equation, but it's a relationship that's pretty common. So there are two 5-second videos. Do you have a? If you can you move your mouse down to the bottom left of that picture, Yeah, there's a play button. Now this is showing. Go back one. Is there? Oh, there it is. There it is, yeah. So this is on a gravel road, and so it's magnifying the impact, but you can see how the road is sinking down and coming back up. So go to the next one. It's even more pronounced. And again, gravel road, so this one's really a. Go back one. Oh, there was the. That was the punchline. So, play this video. This is an even softer gravel road, but the concept is the same. Watch as that tire goes across. It's really washing it down, and then it comes back up. Now on an asphalt road, the next picture. This is what happens if you have a softer base underneath this. Eventually, you get rutting and cracking, and that's the deterioration we're talking about. This is one of the graphs in the report. This is a typical residential street with the typical pavement design and thicknesses, and the solid blue line is just baseline, no extra trucks at all. And then I was asked to analyze this at, we added 5 trucks per week or 10 just to see the impacts. And you can see that equivalent single axle loads, and this is cumulative over the life, over 30 years, life of the pavement, and you can see how on a residential street we're looking at, maybe 130,000, 140,000 in the baseline, but then adding 10 trucks per week, that's about 25,000 more. And that'll be important because when we go back to looking at the different ways I've calculated the estimates of damage in terms of dollars, that's one measure. The pavement condition index, and that starts at 100, and it kind of goes down following the similar curve that I showed at the beginning. As we add more trucks, that decreases faster. And if we look at the age or the difference in the time that it takes to get to that minimum value, it happens a lot more quickly. So if we talk about 40 being a minimum, an example of a minimum acceptable value, it might take 18 years under normal conditions, add 10 trucks a week, and it could be about 15 years. So that 3 years drives these guys crazy because they have to plan all the streets in the network and figure out what is best to do at each street to maintain, to keep that condition high. So I showed this one first, the residential street, because we can really see this. If you look at the next one, the major collector is a higher type of road with more traffic, usually heavier traffic. The impact isn't as much because it's already got a lot of traffic on it. If we just add 5 or 10 trucks a week, it's a small addition. And then the next one on some of your biggest streets, principal arterial, it's almost indistinguishable. There's, we were talking 5 or 10 trucks out of 12,000, or 5 or 10 a week out of 12,000 a day. And so the addition is very minimal.
Question, Mr. Hastings?
So in addition to the relative amount of traffic on there compared to the addition of those minimal amount of trucks, would this also speak to the type of road construction that this is constructed to a higher standard? Or?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Yeah, so the principal is constructed a lot heavier. Okay. And usually with a lot more construction controls on making sure that you're getting what you're asking for. Yes.
But I think that's a really good question. And what percentage do you attribute? Because these lines coalesce to the same point. How much of it is it's virtually no added traffic at these volumes versus the quality of the or the robustness of the construction?
It's both. I mean, I don't know how to divide them up. It depends on the contract quality of the contractor when they're doing the construction. It depends on the quality control. And
I know how to rephrase my question, okay. So maybe elicit an answer because I kind of like an answer. So if we were to do a percentile base increase, would the damage be the same? So if we went back to the first slide where we're on a residential street and we did a percentile increase,
sure,
whatever it is here on the other one, the damage is percentile increased as well, right?
Well, it wouldn't be linear because we talked about the linear increase. If you have a linear increase in traffic, then you'd have, as long as it's the same loads, then it's possibly so.
Okay.
There'd be a linear relationship. If we're talking about increasing the weight, then that's that 40 power.
Right. Okay.
But if it's just increasing the number of trucks, it would But at the same time, I think if we, you know, we're talking about 12,000 trucks a day, or not 12,000 trucks, but maybe 10% of that, we talked about an average daily traffic, which is defined in the report, and then 4, 6, or 8% of that, and then increasing that on a percentage basis, probably wouldn't be a realistic.
Right.
So I think the last slide then is just a summary of the costs that are in that report, and the biggest, the main thing to look at is the residential streets are 72% of the network. And they're the ones that would see the biggest impact with those additional vehicle, heavy vehicles. The range here in each of the cells in this table, say 15 to 23 million, and that's over one life cycle, one 20-year period to be estimated to be in with. That range is pretty large, but there is a lot of variability inherent in materials and pavements and the loads. And so looking at it in three different ways, the percent of life consumed, if we design it to handle a certain amount of traffic, and then we have more of it, then that the extra traffic, the traffic that we weren't expecting will decrease the life of the pavement by a certain percentage. The other way is the average remaining life lost, and you have to forgive me that I don't know how to make a really concise title of something like that, but I'm an engineering professor. The average remaining life lost, though, is if you look at it on that x-axis, how much earlier do we have to do something with it, do something later with it. And then the best one of all is, so I didn't even put this up here, it's just very, very low. These estimates get very small on the low end. But the smallest one is if you can anticipate that heavy traffic now, before you build it, you can build that capacity in at a very minimal cost, and then just plan on that from the beginning. And so as future streets are reconstructed, know that traffic, or can really have a really good estimate that traffic is going to be there, then plan ahead for it, rather than trying to jump and get ahead on the pavement deterioration. So that's all that I have. We have to take your questions.
All right, questions.
Just the basically the plus 5 to plus 10 heavy vehicles per week, that's just kind of an approximation, kind of looking at the garbage hauling that we were looking at then.
That was the idea for to get a boundary on that, on how much that might be.
I'm just kind of curious. Do we currently plan for future traffic as we're reconstructing or building a new road? You know, and what do you do, make it thicker or to compensate for the extra weight?
The road typically is designed based on projected of the 25-year growth in traffic. So we look at what the roll call would tell us would be the traffic projection would be for that road 25 years from now. Yeah. And we design the pavement based on that. I think the exercise here, though, was to kind of get at the point of you've got solid waste collection here that allows an unlimited number of vehicles to come on every street, every week. And it was kind of meant to help frame what that impact would be versus if you just had a single vehicle or two vehicles operating on that street in comparison. So it kind of helped frame that question that's been asked by the Energy Commission and through discussions that we had last year about the impacts of the multiple vehicles with the unlimited curbside garbage collection that we have. And again, since 72% of your streets are residential, and you've got anywhere from 5 to possibly as many as 10 trucks operating on those streets, just to kind of frame for you what that impact could be. Now, as Professor indicated, is that you could design your streets and build them initially to accommodate that. Fortunately for us, sitting here today, and you'll hear about it when we get, I mean, this was pavement design 301, we're going to get into pavement finance 402 here in a minute. But it was meant to kind of help you with the fact that we have this inherent problem today. We have this built set of infrastructure today, and how are we going to deal with it? Because it does, as he showed there, it does decrease the useful life of the street, requires an investment sooner, and in all likelihood requires more frequent maintenance to, in association with that.
Thank you.
Mr. Woodyard.
Would it be, these numbers were typically shown over like 20-year life cycles, those monetary figures that you threw out there. But so it's fair to say that this the excess stress that we're putting on the roads is in fact costing us millions of dollars per year.
Good. Mr. Hickey.
So maybe you're going to cover this in the next hour. I don't want to jump ahead here. But is there any other way to collect back the cost? I mean, there are other models out there. So like when they had the discussion of these frac sand trucks, they just said these heavy trucks are causing this much damage. You have to pay this price to use our roads. Is there a way, is there models out there of other cities that you can charge it back to the heavy trucks and recover it?
Counties have the ability to enact a wheelage tax, and I think that's the way most of the counties that were wrestling with the frac sand issue were addressing that. And that basically allows them to charge based on weight for materials, I believe, that leave the county. I think that's how they tax. In other words, if you're mining and you're exporting, you pay an export tax or a wheelage tax. Cities, I'm not aware cities have that statutory authority for a wheelage tax. As you're aware, you've heard us talk about the street utility. That was kind of the way cities were trying to approach the same thing. But other than special assessments, it's about the only tool you have now other than the property tax. We're going to talk about a few other things, but we don't have the same tools that the counties have, for example.
But there are cities that have taken a completely different approach, which is to limit or reduce the number of garbage haulers to a single garbage hauler or one or two. So that's the other way to do it.
It's easier just to charge more.
Well, we're not charging the garbage companies, well, though. We're charging the consumers.
Well, I don't think we license garbage haulers. They're not.
No, the county has the same.
Yeah. And so I don't know that, again, if the cities have the statutory authority to do so.
Well, Bloomington just did it, so.
Well, they don't have the authority to license, but there are some cities getting into regulating and quarantining their cities and having one hauler.
Districting it.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of that's fairly new in Minnesota that they're doing that.
Yeah. Mr. Ruska.
Kind of similar but different, the picture that he showed up there was FedEx. And so on top of we talking about, you know, garbage, but there's also those vehicles that run around neighborhoods every day. Yeah. And so, I mean, there's probably, if you work to fix one, you probably aren't going to be able to fix the other, right? Or is it, I mean, I think about all the different kind of vehicles that run through neighborhoods and up and down.
I think it's just a matter of how creative you want to get for some of the solutions. And so, again, some communities have gone to district garbage collection as a way to address this. I don't know that anybody's done districting for parcel delivery.
That'd be interesting. But can you draw maybe theorize a similar picture for what a garbage truck distribution would be for like this?
Yes, and yeah, and it would be on the order of the 12,000 pound steering axle and then one set of axles in the back that has 30,000 to 40,000 pounds.
I would comment one thing this points out is usually the debate over quadranting the city for garbage is, you know, we want freedom to choose who we want, but the piece that's missing is what is the cost that might be incurring for the community, and this kind of information I think is pretty useful to try to put some parameters around it, because when people take that other position, they don't know the other side of it, so, and then people can make a more informed decision. Useful information, I guess.
And in the end, they're all legal loads. They're not necessarily overloaded or anything. They're just illegal loads. And so that's where it comes back to what Richard said, is how do you want to handle the impact that we know would have.
So I think it'd be on this chart that's up here, could you just restate what those values, those dollar values represent, the $15 to $23 million? What does that represent? Is that all right?
That's
not an annual cost. From a perspective, is it an annual cost? Is it the cost? cost over the life of the pavement?
Right.
Is it a 20-year cost, I think, to quantify those numbers?
And these are costs over a 20-year analysis period. If we looked at traffic for 20 years, then with those increases of 5 or 10 heavy vehicles every week, these are over the life cycle of the street network of 72% of the streets. So over 20 years, it's an extra 7 to 10 or so, $11 million or so, just looking at it that way. So, but it is a significant, it adds up to a significant amount. These numbers are smaller just because of the relative.
So, what is the cost difference between 6-ton road and the principal arterial type street, which is 10-ton or whatever?
The 6-ton road?
I mean, residential streets are mostly 6-ton,
right.
Probably, and the arterial are probably 10-tons. So, what is the cost difference to build the residential or...
Oh, the difference?
Yeah.
Cost to build them? I'd have to defer to the focus department.
Yeah, anywhere from $300 to $400 of centerline foot difference.
This is why, the very minimal initial cost, once you do it, all that work to build a street, add a little bit to it. This is why a lot of the paving associations will come in and they'll sell you on their type of pavement, and then once they get you on cost, then they say, hey, just add a little bit. You can add a lot of life. So, yes, we'll build a 6-ton road or a residential or a 9, the local road research board or the local agencies have built a 9-ton and then go into the 10-ton system. It takes time because every time they reconstruct, they'll add to it.
So, could you talk to the seasonal effects of this? Because obviously we have plows that run in the winter, but my understanding is if the ground's frozen solid, it's less destructive than shoulder seasons.
Yes. Yeah. A lot of the damage happens in the thawing season. And I think MnDOT defines two. There's the spring. There's the early spring and the spring, two different thawing seasons. And when it's frozen, some of the other work that I've done with them, they don't really consider the damage that's done during the frozen time.
So again, in the spring, for example, on streets that don't have curb, we will usually wait and sweep those streets the last because the edge of the road is the most vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to garbage collection, where does that garbage truck need to operate? Up against the curb, particularly at the stops. So, it's curb and gutter helps a lot as far as protecting that edge of the road. But the edge is the most vulnerable, particularly on streets that don't have curb and gutter. And in the spring is the worst time of the year.
I was going to just comment quickly on Mr. Ruska's comment earlier. I think we have to be cognizant of all the heavy truck traffic that might be on the streets. Certainly delivery vehicles and the garbage haulers we talked about. Even some of our own vehicles, public works, service vehicles and so forth. So it's a bigger picture. The other thing I'm curious about, and you don't have to answer this, but somehow you'd have to quantify, let's say we talk about garbage haulers and we reduce from 5 to 1 truck a week on a particular street, but that one truck is going to make more trips because the truck only has so much capacity, so it's still got to... So somehow you've got to reconcile that. It's not as simple as just going from 4 or 5 trucks a week down to 1, and there's an equivalency there because they still have to do a certain amount of business to take care of that.
But I think that the additional trips that it's making are on those heavier roads that can handle the extra without very minimal additional. It wouldn't be driving on the same residential street 5 times.
Mm-hmm.
As they go down and do the collection on one residential street and then get on the major streets.
Yeah.
As it goes to Duncan.
Yeah. And all I'm suggesting, it gets a little interesting to try to model all that. So, Mr. Campion, you had your hand.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if you break it down per household cost, I took the $30 million estimate over 20 years and then divided by the 46,000 households or so. I know that number has already been debated here, but... If it's 46,000, that's $32.60 a year for 10 heavy vehicle trips per week. Like, that's a really, I mean, that burden gets to be really significant. So when you start looking at this in terms of fully funding the necessary road maintenance projects, this really seems to, it's really important to me to boil it down to what the actual cost is for my household and for all the households I represent. That's, you know, a really big burden.
Okay, Mr. Wojcik.
So, you know, part of why it's important having, you know, the state expert on this topic here is so that we don't let elected officials muddy up the topic at all. We can see how much potential savings there are by reducing the number of garbage hauling vehicles, and nothing the political class is going to say is going to change the reality of these numbers. I point to, there's the direct and the indirect savings as well. Bloomington, which has about 26,000 households, they're projected to save about $13 million based on their monthly cost, just because of the efficiency of having the better system in place. That's not counting these additional heavy vehicle ones. So I just don't want anyone to have any vagary or lack of concise clearness that the decision to have multiple garbage haulers out there are costing our citizens millions of dollars, and there's just no gray area there.
And what I try to do is give you the information. I always tell the county engineers when I meet with them, give you the information so that they can make better decisions. hopefully more informed decisions.
All right. Any other final comments or questions? I know this is going to be a great lead-in to the next topic.
Yes.
So.
It's unrelated, actually.
All right. Well, thank you very much. All right. Mr. Freeze, you're up.
Your name's
the energy guy.
Well, you've been asking for a couple months now the report on the status of funding. And basically, I look at it more as from the perspective of investment strategies for streets. So Dale and I have worked up this presentation with the help of Doug and Russ from Public Works. And I think the professor's presentation gave you a good feeling for what how roads deteriorate, and what we want to do is expand upon that a little bit today and talk to you about some funding options. I realize that based on the time and the amount of the information we're going to give you is that we don't expect an answer from you today at all. And I've asked Randy if it would be appropriate for us to come back in 2 weeks on the 22nd, put this on the agenda again, and give you an opportunity to think about it for 2 weeks. We can provide the PowerPoint for you. You'll have the statistics and look at what might be both a short-term and a long-term funding strategy for addressing how we're going to invest in our streets going forward. So Doug's going to run the presentations here. The network is broken down into state, county, and city streets. We're going to talk today about the 467 miles of city streets. And that's further broken down into, as was alluded to earlier, we have 92 miles of MSA streets, which are our arterials and our collectors. We've got about 10 miles of alleys, which we don't put very much money in the budget for, and we have 365 miles of local streets. Here's a graph that shows, a chart that shows the age of your streets, and you've got over 107 miles of streets that are 51 years or older. When I first came to Rochester over 20 years ago, the industry itself, my profession, was using 30 years as the average life of a street. That's what we were taught. That was basically the design. And as you saw in the slides that the professor provided, 30 years was the expected life of a street. We now realize we can't replace streets every 30 years. We've got to do more to basically make them last at least 50. So we've converted over the last 20 years to a 50-year life cycle approach to maintaining streets. But you can see here the challenges before us. You also see the boom that we experienced there in the blue column, the growth in the community of streets now that are between 10 and 20 years old, from basically the mid-1990s to the recession in about 2006. So a significant challenge that is going to be coming our direction in addition to the backlog that currently exists. So this is just a map. It's really hard to see, but the colors, the red colors represent the older streets going down to the lightest color representing the newer streets. But you can see that the concentration of older streets, obviously, is in the part of the community that existed back in the 50s and 60s. There's something called Pavement Condition Index, and it basically is a way to evaluate every street and give it a condition rating between 0 and 100. The software program that we use primarily evaluates the surface condition, and in a lot of respects, MnDOT refers to that more toward the rideability of a street, a rideability index. So we're still using the 0 to 100, but it's more of the surface condition. And to the credit of the public works staff, I believe that we have a system that is very good when it comes to the surface condition of a lot of our streets. You can see how much of the inventory is good or very good, and how little of it is fair or poor. But again, this is just the surface condition. And streets are like a lot of other things. They're everything wears out, and street is no different. And it doesn't matter how good it looks on the surface. It's like a house. You can keep painting it. Eventually, that wood will rot if you don't do something to keep it so that it lasts. Surface condition index, again, just a couple examples of what a good pavement would look like, what a fair pavement would look like, and what a poor pavement would look like. So see some examples from around the city. And as you're all aware, surface of the street is one thing. We have sidewalks, and then we have all sorts of utilities, public and private, buried underneath the streets, which again contribute to, in some respects, the degradation of the street due to utility trench settlement, water main breaks and sewer collapses and things like that, all lead to a degradation that makes it very difficult to get the street for the last 50 years. So we talked about the different classifications of streets, and as a result, there's going to be different ranges of the wear course, the top lift of asphalt, the base course, the aggregate base itself, and then the natural soils. Unfortunately, in Rochester and southeast Minnesota, we're challenged with very poor soils, karst geology, soft soils. It's very difficult. We don't have a lot of good quality aggregate materials in this part of the state. So our challenges are even more complicated now because of the quality of not only of the subgrade, but of the aggregate materials that we have available for us in designing and constructing the pavements. So again, pretty obvious, 100 is a new street or brand new street. We start there. And you saw this curve in a kind of a different fashion here, basically a degradation curve showing that the pavement would generally deteriorate over 30 years if it wasn't properly maintained. Preventative maintenance. So we expanded our efforts over the years in joint and crack sealing. Again, this is a pretty standard term here. The professor indicated he had some other examples, but the literature I see and the average is if you spend a dollar on preservation early in that first period of time of the age of the street, you can avoid spending $6 to $10 later on future rehabs or reconstructions. And so we've made a concerted effort to do a lot more in the preventive maintenance, whether it's crack sealing or seal coating or chip sealing. And I realize the citizens really don't like this. We've gotten a lot better at it over the years. It's a real pain. But it does serve a purpose, and it's a very cost-effective preventative maintenance pavement strategy. So as was alluded to by the professor, if you make an investment at the right time in the age of a street based on observations and conditions, you can extend the useful life. So here's an example of making an investment in an overlay at about year 17, and how we're able to basically add somewhere in the vicinity of about 7 years to the life of the street. Again, you all familiar with this. We do edge mills here on the left, where we grind off a couple inch and a half to 2 inches along the curb. resurface the street. In some cases, we do full mills all the way across. Generally, those happen after we've done several edge mills and the crown gets too high, and it's difficult sometimes for people to get in and out of the driveways. So again, some other pictures here of mill and overlay. And then the dreaded street reconstruction, and I've addressed neighborhood groups for years, and this is the summer from hell. And I tell them that right up front, is that we haven't lost anybody. Everybody survived, but it's probably the most uncomfortable summer of your life when it comes to access to your business or your home. And it's also the most expensive.
We have a question, Mr. Hickey.
I just had a quick question.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe you're going to go into that. How many times do you, like, is there a ratio, like we do this many chip seals and we have to do a mill and overlay?
Okay. As long as you're paused.
You read ahead.
Six right, per sorry. 50 chips, yes.
As long as you're paused, is zero, the professor mentioned, working toward what's your acceptable rate? In these slides that you're presenting, zero PCI represents to us an unacceptable road. That's our threshold.
Technically, about a 20 is considered a failure in the rating okay. system, but the charts need to start at zero. And
sure.
He used 40 as an example. Yeah. I wish we were at a point that we could afford 40 being unacceptable, but 20 is kind of the standard that we use here.
So it's not just that this is a subjective measurement and we're baselining our zero to be what his 40 is. It's literally that we're accepting roads that are substandard to what their 40 is.
That picture we showed of a yeah. pavement, I think, was a 20. So, I mean, it's fully alligatored. It's,
and there'd be be relatively consistent appraisal of what the PCI. Okay.
Our inspectors are all trained basically based on the observation, the percent cracking, the type of cracking.
Sure.
It all leads to a reading.
So the stress manual that outlines that, and we take them through kind of a curriculum to teach them how to do it.
Okay. So here's an example of ideally what we'd like to be able to do. The sooner you can put a chip seal or a fog seal on the road, the better. Think, well, why would we want to do that? We just built it 2 years ago. That pavement deteriorates from the top down as well as from the bottom up, and bituminous has oil in it, and that oil oxidizes because of the sunlight. So the sooner we can seal that surface, that initial constructed bituminous lift, the better. We're trying to get it in basically somewhere in the first 3 to 5 years, and that along with crack filling, and do a second one before we would do an overlay at about year 17. We would repeat the process, again, an overlay in about year 34, 35. And with, so you can see, 6 chip seals and 2 overlays on a bituminous street, we feel we can get 50 years worth of useful life. So this is what the theory, if you will, what we would like to see that as our practice, and we're trying to practice this to the best of our ability based on the availability funding. But this is the basis under which the numbers that we're going to give you, the dollar amounts, the value, if you will, of what we need to do from an investment perspective. It's this approach that's is the basis for that. So our current funding for preservation, seal coats and crack filling, is about $200,000. Our rehabilitation, which includes our mill and overlays, is about $1.8 million. And our construction and reconstruction, which consists of about $4 million of municipal state aid and between $2 and $3 million of federal aid, we've been averaging about $9 million a year. So, Doug, if you just go back. So, again, based on this approach to funding a road for 50 years, and again, you've heard me say, if we have 500 miles, easy math, 500 miles of road and they last 50 years, that means we need to do 10 miles of reconstruction a year. And if we need to do 10 miles of reconstruction a year, then we need to do so many overlays, and so many overlays and so many chip seals. So all what that all computes to then is about $32 million worth of funding is what's necessary to maintain our street network of 467 miles of roads. That's $23 million short of where we are today. We currently have a backlog of about $235 million worth of reconstruction. Again, that's based on that 107 miles of streets that were 50 years or older.
What was that number again? Where is that?
$235
million. $235, okay.
This deck will be forthcoming, I hope.
What's that?
This deck will be sent to us, I hope, so I can respond.
Yes. Yep. Mm-hmm. What we projected then is in 10-year increments here, so 2016 to 2025, so these are 10-year increments. So if you kind of look across the bottom here, this is about $16.5 million, $16.6 million each year for that 10-year period would be necessary, ignoring the backlog, which is basically starting now and going forward, not considering this. I'm going to show you what that investment, these numbers would have to be in order to address this backlog. But you can see how that number grows from 16.5 million a year for 10 years, 19.8 a year for 10 years, 25.2. And then remember that blue bar that was so large because of all those streets that were built for that 20 years? Now we're up to 45 million, again, based on that 50-year approach. Now the next slide.
The backlog's in there.
Oh, the backlog's in here. I'm sorry. Okay. So now we put that backlog in here, and we basically address that backlog over 20 years. So these two decades, we've added that backlog of 235 million. And you can see how this number has grown now from 16 million to 28 million a year and up to 31. And again, this number stays the same, and this number is the same because we've addressed the backlog. So if we were to address the backlog over the next 20 years, again, we're looking at an investment of about $28 to $31 million. And this is basically a miles comparison. So these are the type of miles. We're reconstructing probably somewhere in the neighborhood of less than 5 miles a street a year. This is what we would have to do in order to address the backlog. So you can see what the impact would be to do that. And I mean, I have to admit to you, there isn't the capacity in contractors, equipment, and whatever to do this. So, you know, realistically speaking, even if we could afford to do it, there aren't contractors enough, there isn't equipment enough, there aren't the resources, if you will, not the financial, but the other part, the other resources, to get it done. So we're going to have to work at phasing this in. And I think that's just one practical from the perspective of the financial impact, but also of the construction industry itself.
I just want to capture that statement in my mind because I think it's really impactful. Is we cannot, with manpower, eliminate money off the table. We couldn't, with manpower, work through our maintenance backlog in the next 20 years.
That's my, well, I think over, but
you don't have to avoid this. I want to make sure I get the points because it's a really important point.
I mean, we could, if you were to say, okay, Richard, we're going to give you what you need, and go back a slide, and we're going to build, start rebuilding 8.5 million. So this, we have to divide this by 8.5 million miles of street.
8.5 miles.
8.5 miles a year. I don't think right now there's the horsepower, the capability of the contractors in the area to do that. Now, what would happen is that we would see more contractors coming to our area. People would come and make an investment here if there was that kind of investment. But it's not going to happen overnight. It could take 5, 10, 15 years for that to happen. But I think, practically speaking, even if you gave us the money, we couldn't probably spend it because the capability in the contracting business isn't here.
Okay. That's
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So again, kind of what the annual need is in the form of dollars and how it would then be spent. So again, you know, 25 million of that would be spent on reconstruction, resurfacing, which we've been able to do a pretty good job of keeping up, and the preventative, which we've again been investing a lot of time and money and trying to get, again, that group of streets that's approaching 20 years to keep them in as good a condition as possible in the anticipation that there's going to be a long-term financing policy. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dale, who's going to have all the answers for you.
Well, it looks like you found the answer right there.
So we're going to pass the hat.
Look at this.
Take a moment. So again, I'm just going to quickly run through some different ideas. None of this is new enough. None of it's rocket science. It's just, what are your options of trying to address this gap? And again, with the idea that probably can't even spend it all if you gave it all to us in 1 year anyway, but we need to ramp up somehow to get this, because if you saw in Richard's slides there, by the time you get to 2046, there's a whole other big mess to deal with, just because there's so many that were built on a timeline that they're all going to become coming for reconstruction. So if we keep holding this off forever, we'll have basically the whole town kind of fall apart at once. So again, I'm going to walk through each of these, but special assessments has kind of been the traditional answer in the past. Tax levy, street utility concept, which we're going to talk to you about, just coupling it with a franchise option. Geo improvement bonds, basically just going out borrowing money, and then some other ideas, but most likely it'll probably be some combination of the above. The street assessments that we used to be the traditional method follows the section Minnesota Statutes 429, but there's also a law that basically requires you to be able to prove benefit of the market value of like amount that you're charging, and that's basically been really impossible to do. So we end up, I think we said, we're basically, if we're lucky, collecting about 25% of the actual reconstruction cost through an assessment. You just can't levy enough, because then you end up spending all your time in negotiations with the attorneys and or in court, basically, over the amount that you're levying on assessment. You cannot collect at all the cost per linear foot of a reconstruction. If you go and try and assess it, you basically get a bunch of pushback. You also end up with all the hearings and the petitions against it by various neighbors. In my previous town, we basically got to a point where we just said, look, we don't want to have this fight. We'll basically have the hearing. If there aren't enough people that are supporting it, we'll just leave it go, and we'll get to a point where we just do minimal maintenance, was basically just putting gravel on the street to fill the potholes, and eventually people came back and begged you to assess them for it. But you know, again, we haven't been willing to do that, and I'm not saying that's the best answer here either. I'm just saying that you always end up with some sort of a hearing and a lot of controversy over whether or not you're ready to charge them. And then from my perspective, there's this 10-year assessment for at least a 20-year or maybe more improvement before you need to come back and do a reconstruction again. So you have one homeowner that moves in and it's time to reconstruct their street. They pay for it over the next 10 years, but that reconstruction portion, if they do the maintenance properly, is really good for 50 years. Yet they ended up paying for that.
And just kind of, this goes back to about the mid-70s, I think is the biggest reason the city's struggling keeping up with their roads. Basically, until that time, most cities assessed 100% of the cost of the streets and got them. It worked. There were some cities who did it for higher capacity streets than just residential streets. And there were some court cases that kind of flipped that on its head. The legislature said you've got to prove like an actual increase in the value of the home. And that's difficult to prove. And the same thing applies to like particularly the new sewer and water lines, which are underground. You'll never prove, you know, that that's going to increase the value of the home. Like, and really no alternative has come back since then to try and replace that. And I think that there's a number of cities in the state that have huge backlogs as well as we do, and because you shifted from assessments to tax levy, property tax levy. I mean, that's really the only alternative you have, or more state aid, which also is not forthcoming. So I just wanted to give you a little of the history, because it wasn't always this way with us. And it could have been, I think, done better and different, but that didn't happen.
And the last point I want to make is that right now we're only doing these on reconstructions, we're only levying assessments. There are some cities that when they come and do an overlay, they charge a much smaller, but something that covers helps to cover that cost, to pay that cost for an overlay maintenance. And again, that maybe ties a little more in line with the length of the value of the assessment over time versus the value of the improvement to the road. The other option, of course, is the tax levy. And again, I'm just throwing this up and so that you get some idea. I mean, if we did it all right now, strictly on a tax levy, at $23 million over our existing $57 million levy, is a 40% increase on top of what people are currently paying. But if you just look at each additional $1 million in levy, it splits out to roughly a 1.8% in city levy or a 0.65 increase in the total property tax bill for residential property. That amounts to about $16 a year for a $192,000 median home value in Rochester, or $27 a year for a $300,000 home for each $1 million increase. And I've listed below that what the impact on some of the commercials are, which of course pay a higher rate per dollar value. Whoops. Yeah, you're still low.
So when you get down to a
$12 million business, you're up to $2,200 a year for an impact on the tax levy. It is, however, income tax deductible, so every time we talk about some kind of fee or another, we always hear this, well, why don't you just levy it to us? But then, of course, when it comes time for the tax levy, nobody's standing there saying, well, increase the levy, but everybody does say that if it's some other cost, put it on the taxes, because then we can at least write it off on our tax, or put it on the property tax, because we can write it off on our income tax. But it does not recover dollars from property tax exempt parcels, and yet they also benefit from these improvements. And it is also, depending on how we do this, subject to levy limits, given when those return. And maybe a number of you have been around during those times when we got ourselves kind of locked in with different kinds of things that we thought we had a plan to increase, but then we come along with levy limits instituted by the state, and we couldn't increase it in the next year. So even if you put together a plan to increase it by $1 million a year, you maybe couldn't actually do so if the levy limits came in place.
I think that was about 7 out of 10 years back in the 90s, early 2000s.
So another idea is this street utility concept, and I know we've talked to you about it before, but we brought it forward on a sidewalk utility here recently. Right now, there is not a law in place that allows a street utility strictly to be levied as a utility, but there are cities like Elk River, St. Louis Park, and others that have basically used a franchise fee, and some of them have done it for over a decade now, on their gas and electric bills to maintain the right of the right of way. So they're using that money to do the maintenance version of a street repair. So again, I just took a look at Elk River, took their pricing and applied to the housing and the service levels that we have based on Rochester's electric RPU's service levels, and tried to apply that to our customer base using their fee structure. And it ends up generating about $8 million a year. And then again, someone could argue, well, that cable franchise fee that we get, that really is doing the same thing that we're trying to instill on the gas and electric bill. So if you added that to it, and again, I realize that's taking it away from the general fund, but the general fund is funding the street maintenance right now anyway. But that adds up to about $9.5 million. It doesn't get us all the way there, but again, it's one method of getting it there. It does then at least apply it to all properties in the city, whether they're tax exempt or not. It just becomes another add-on to the gas bill, and it does becomes another add-on to the electric bill. We did have that argument again about how it's not, you can't write that off on your personal property taxes, but it would be a way to generate money to maintain the roadways. And then there's also, of course, just borrow the money.
We have to pay that back, right?
Right. And this is outside of the idea of a special assessments, because in special assessments, we still probably often go out and borrow money and then get it paid back with a special assessment. But this would be what they call a GO capital improvement bond. As long as we have these in our five-year CIP, we just go out and borrow money with a GO backing on it. But it does provide upfront funding to meet some of the backlog. Again, trying to think about maybe some combination of all these different options. But it would dedicate a portion of annual funding towards debt service payments then. So each $1 million in additional annual cash flow, so if you want to equate that to some portion of a franchise fee, or $1 million a year of additional money on the tax levy, it would generate roughly $15 million in upfront cash to provide project funding. Considered a 20-year bond, 3% interest. You wouldn't want to tie up all your street revenues for the debt payments, but maybe, again, some portion to help deal with the backlog. And the other strategies is do nothing. I don't know, Richard made it. We did actually, Richard brought this presentation or something similar to it back to a number of years ago, and we really haven't been able to get
exactly
a lot.
Exactly 19 years ago, I found my presentation, 1997.
So the backlog has obviously gotten larger, and we haven't really done much other than take the money we had and did a lot of resurfacing. Again, that fixes that condition index, but it's that underground support structure that eventually starts to deteriorate and fall apart under you. So you can't really put bubble gum on top of it when it's falling apart underneath. So, so the other, it basically to kind of do any combination of these things. I mean, you could do the tax levy of a certain amount, grow it over time, and also institute the franchise fee to support the program, and maybe do a lesser amount at first and build that up over time. Or you could modify or update your assessment program maybe to hit the overlay sections and not just realizing you haven't been able to generate enough to do the reconstruction part, perhaps, but you could assess for an overlay and be able to support that probably in the court. Again, we could wait for the state legislature to pass a street utility. There's even a solar roadway option. Don't know if that's tried and true yet, but the state of Missouri is actually doing something like that. So it's actually these little solar panels that get plugged into a roadway, and they actually generate electricity. And they're trying a project where they would do basically some private public partnership things to generate electricity to pay for the road. So I got a copy of this if you want to take a look at it. So, and any other ideas you might have, we're open to it. And with that, I'll turn it back over to Richard. And he's got all the next steps.
So as I indicated at the start, is that we really would like to ask that you adopt a strategy to begin doing something. We're at the point now that we've got to have a plan. We talked about it a little bit in last December as part of the budget process and the budget hearing. A short-term strategy and a long-term strategy, something, again, that we can work together, both the council and the staff, in developing a couple of, again, just some examples here. Develop a 10-year strategy to increase funding by $2 million a year, gets you additional $20 million, or a 5-year strategy to increase by $4 million a year, or develop a 6-year strategy where you $1 million the first year, $2 million the second, $3 million the third. So again, that builds up to, you know, $21 million. Or a multi-year strategy, create dedicated franchise fee to pay for preventative maintenance, for example, like St. Louis Park and Elk River we're doing, and a multi-year strategy for tax increases to pay for rehab and reconstruction process projects. So again, there's a multiple different ways you could finance this thing. We're at the point, though, we need to have a strategy. The council needs to be, staff feels the council needs to be on record with a strategy. It's going to help you, I think, and help us, again, kind of grow into what we need in the way of an annual revenue stream. And as I said, we knew we'd be running long today. We'd be happy to answer any questions, but we've formally set up an opportunity to discuss this again in 2 weeks. August
22nd,
Mr. Ruska. Richard, the 20% that you talked about that are in that kind of dire need, right? I don't know what slide that was, but you had a slide back there that showed that some are really bad shape, right? I'm just wondering, is there a way that you could send us a list of those roads? I'd like to go out and visit some of them and see, you know. I mean, I think overall I'm pretty impressed with the job the staff does. There's a lot of...
The problem, as I indicated, was that the surface will appear a lot better in most cases than what the rating of the road is. And the rating of the road is based on a lot of input factors. And we may have actually gone out and resurfaced that 20 3 years ago. And so, you know, on our chart right now, you know, it'll still show pretty poor condition. But it's,
I guess for my perspective, I'd like to go out and see some of those so I can relate.
You want it just in your ward or?
Just citywide.
Okay.
Sure. And he's sharing with everyone.
Sure.
I'd be interested to hear that.
All right. Mr. Campion.
So on the, if you can go to the chart where it lays out that 50-year timeline we've managed to generate. So it looks like at the end of 50 years, we're still at about 60. So I'm going to ask you the tough question, which is that telling me that with continued strategy of chip seal and overlays, we can drag these things out to 75 years?
Concrete Street, I would say that I would unequivocally say yes. Bituminous Street, again, the quality of the aggregate material, the aggregate that we have, is our biggest challenge with our bituminous streets. So we've shown it this way. We don't know, to be honest with you. I can't tell you, and again, I think the profession has changed just in my 20 years here in Rochester to the point that we never were talking about a 50-year life cycle on the road. We never were talking. Yeah. And now we realize that, as I say, those investments that you make earlier in the life of the street and the more frequent you make them, I mean, you can't, the longer... the older the street gets, you can't continue to go at a 17-year increment on overlays. Even though we showed that, it's probably 17 years, then it's probably at year 30, and then maybe at year 42. Something, it's going to shorten up, but you're still, it's cheaper than reconstructing.
And I'm not an engineer.
We have to address drainage. We have, how many miles of street do we have that do not have curb? You know off the top of your head, roughly?
Close to 200.
So out of the 467, we have 200 miles that don't have any curb and gutter. So we've got drainage issues. So those streets, in all likelihood, will never last 50 years.
What you don't see is that aggregate base that carries that bituminous surface, is that the constant loading of that is that that rock gets pulverized, and now it becomes mush, it becomes fines. That's the mush.
I trust you guys to figure that part out. I guess the graph suggested that there may be opportunity to lengthen the lifespan, but we
don't know, because Doug's point is correct. But you know, we used to build streets full depth asphalt pavement.
Yeah,
that was the fad, if you will, the trend back in the 70s. We don't do that anymore because asphalt prices have gotten so high.
One more suggestion, if I might. Slide 24 or 25, either one of those two. I think that this should be on. Sorry, if you would. I think this is something that should come in our packets with each development to show what we have in 2056, so we know that if we're already running, what they did in 2046 to 2055 to us in terms of future cost, we're not doing the same thing to a council 40 years from now that they're going to have the same sort. I mean, hopefully the technology is rolling on some sort of magical roadway by then, but if we're not, and we still have to maintain them the same way we maintain our roadways today, not knowing what we're doing to future councils is a pretty big problem to me. So like getting the staff report that says, you want to approve the subdivision generates this much in 50-year maintenance costs, and this is what is already out there committed for 50 years from now. I think that's a huge thing we should know when we're making a decision.
And we haven't really talked about the future as it relates to road design, but again, you know, we've moved in the last 10 years to complete streets, narrower streets, things like that, so there's less cost associated with initial construction and maintenance as we narrow up streets and go to, you know, 12-foot lanes to 11-foot lanes to probably 10-foot lanes in the future. So a lot of those things will affect the future.
It's really easy to talk about the future. You're asking for today, and I understand that's the hard question for us to figure out.
Right, so, but we've got an existing problem that we need to start addressing. Because there's another wave, as Dale mentioned, coming to you in about 30 years here of a significant amount of streets that are going to be in need of repair and actually replacement.
Okay, Mr. Wojak?
Well, my understanding, too, is that these tend to be conservative numbers, because what this doesn't get into is the construction inflation, and that runs well ahead of regular inflation. And I think it's fair to say that the construction inflation is significantly more at this point than the cost of capital for the city. Would that be fair, Dale? Reason why I asked that is I actually ran these numbers, this $2.9 million shortfall over the 50-year life, and added in our current pent-up liability. And that actually comes out to just under $1.4 billion net present value. So that's how big of a hole we as a community have dug for ourselves. $1.4 billion. That absolutely dwarfs any kind of pension liability we as a community are talking about. And that kind of financial burden will take away from our ability to provide every service, be it public safety, parks, library, arts, anything else we want to do as a community. We're heading towards a financial train wreck. And I've been so excited to get these numbers because we had to realize where we were at. Looking forward is a huge opportunity, because every single time we don't look at the return on investment of a new piece of public infrastructure that we accept, we dig this hole even bigger. Every single one of these cul-de-sacs that we accept as a public roadway increases this massive liability that we've created for the community. I can look at two new developments in my area. One has private cul-de-sacs, which add zero to this. The other has public cul-de-sacs, and for some inexplicable reason, we're not consistent with that. But we have the only way to wear this down in the long run is we've got to become more efficient and realize these last 40 years, we've just perpetually shot ourselves in the foot with this kind of infrastructure. I do hope, you know, I proposed, I showed a chart very similar to what Richard's talking about here last year in the budgeting cycle, where I showed how much, you know, a plan to add so much to funding every particular year to address this kind of long-term liability. It didn't go anywhere. We were going to wait until we saw this, but we have got to take action. It's unfortunate that when the sprawl stops, when the Ponzi scheme stops, it's that generation that kind of bears the burden of what previous generations and previous decisions did to them. But at some point, we have to get responsible here, and we just have not done it at this point. Nick's comment, I want to see when, before we ever accept another piece of public infrastructure, I want to know if the supporting land uses are productive enough to actually pay for it. If it's not, why do we keep accepting money-losing investments? You can't. The more money-losing pieces of infrastructure we put, the bigger this hole is going to get. So I think the time for wishful thinking and saying, we're just going to share these costs, we're going to pass along, those days are over with. The data is so crystal clear right now. We can't continue going down this path. So I look forward to what the council decides we're going to do to address this issue and hopefully not just punt it down the road another 19 years.
Is there the LMC, have they addressed this issue? I can't believe we're not the only city facing this sort of backlog. I mean, one of the things you throw up there is, you know, wait for legislative action, but I almost think we should be calling in whatever chips we have with them.
That's curious. I mean, we've tried a number of different years.
It would augment this, or it would help. Yeah. It's not the total solution, but like you have a stormwater utility, you know, $5 million a year. You got all kinds of utilities. We have electric utilities, storm utilities, sewer utilities. You know, but they won't give cities the authority for a transportation utility. And it's been in bills for a decade, I'll bet.
Longer than that.
And it would be the single best thing that I think that could happen. And it just doesn't seem to get anywhere.
I mean, the other thing that could change is the assessment statute.
That would be another.
There are other states that basically you have to show benefit, but you don't have to prove it with an increase in market value. So I think everybody has heard the term curb appeal, and a brand new street in front of a house that's for sale is going to show and sell a lot better than a street that's valued at 20 and full of potholes. Some states, that's all the test you have to show. You have to show a benefit, but you don't have to show that benefit is equivalent to the $2,000 assessment and that the value of the house goes up. I actually hosted the Association, Rochester Association of Builders, for a luncheon 19 years ago in this very room and asked them why, when they do an appraisal of the house, don't they consider the condition of the street in front of the house just like they do the condition of the roof? If it's got a bad roof on it, they devalue the structure. If it's got old appliances in it or, you know, an old furnace, they devalue. So if the condition of the street is bad, why don't you devalue the property? Because a new street would add value to the property. You know what I got for an answer? And I just asked PB not quote me on this.
I don't think that works, but no. Go ahead.
The answer they got is the law doesn't require us, as part of an appraisal, to value or to appraise the condition of the public improvements in the public right-of-way. They completely agreed with my analogy, but the appraisal process didn't require them to do it, so they weren't doing it, and they wouldn't do it. And so I got acknowledgement of my point, but they don't do it because they're not required to, and end of story. So it's unfortunate that we have a state law that requires that, but yet from an appraisal, and that's why it's so difficult to prove in court. The last assessment project we had that we were challenged on, we spent more money on appraisals than we actually collected in assessments.
Even if you had a policy in the state that you could be a presumed assessment of 50%, that would be legitimate, would be double what we
Your policy is to recover 25% of the cost from the property owner on each side of the road, a total of 50%, and property taxes are to pay the other 50%. That's your policy. By the time we get it done in court, things get challenged. We're not even getting 20% now. And like I say, the last one, we actually spent more on the appraisals than we got in the form of the assessments.
Mr. Wodgar.
So regardless whether it's by assessment or by property taxes, we still have to pay the costs, and the costs are very substantial either way. The group that should be leading the charge on it has been conspicuously silent as the business community. In particular, what you have to remember is when it falls to the property tax base, property taxes are heavily weighted in the state of Minnesota towards those business properties, and it is the business community that's picking up the burden of subsidizing all these money-losing residential streets we have. And yet, not only has the business community been silent on this, they've actually been advocating for the policies that have dug us further and further into debt, and they need to help us lead the charge and address the unsustainability of the current system.
So we'd like to meet with you again in 2 weeks. Again, in the meantime, if any of you have any questions, we'll try to get you that list here yet this week, so you can have a chance to kind of go out and look around. We'll look forward to the discussion in 2 weeks.
Yeah, with me, then Mr. Bilderback.
I just have a question. The solar panels that are going trial in Missouri, do you have any information on how it's just something
just
that's going to happen down there?
Did you make it up?
No,
I didn't make it up. I'll send you a copy.
Mr. Bilderback.
Richard, Dale, can you make sure you send us also the different options that you're asking us to consider?
Give me the whole thing.
Yeah. It's a big file right now. It's eight megs. It's on the Public Works website.
Okay.
So that might be
the
easiest way for you to go out and see it.
The different options.
Yeah, I'd like to. Mr. Wodgar.
Well, can we switch gears? I did want to bring out, I told staff I was going to bring this up, that for the second time in the period of just a few months, we've had another residential property torn down for the purposes of a surface parking lot in a neighborhood. If this were happening in neighborhoods where doctors live, there would be action taken, but this keeps happening in the core neighborhoods, and I'm going to attempt to get some sort of a moratorium specifically limited to residential teardowns to become surface parking lots, not redevelopments, not full redevelopments, but I just think it's ridiculous that this continues to happen time and time again, and I'm do my best to bring that up for a vote at the next meeting. So I just want to give the heads up so staff is prepared. If they have any comments on that, they should reach out to me. And then the other issue is I'm interested in perhaps getting an update from the city attorney on what rights we have in terms of demolition by neglect. The Kutsky home is still sitting with no roof on it right now, and it's pretty clear at this point they're trying to destroy that building enough so they can tear it down and do something else with it. And I want to make sure that there are severe punitive fines for betraying the public trust and the contract with the public on a property like that. And I'm curious from a legal perspective what we can do to address that kind of neglect.
All right. Mr. Hickey?
So your proposal, is this something we're going to see in writing? I mean,
It'll essentially be exactly what I just said. My preference would be the staff would draft it because they could get to the heart of it more.
So, I mean, what I read in the Post Bulletin is that the house was torn down because it had asbestos and mold issues and whatever.
Yes.
So it wouldn't prevent them from tearing down the house. They just couldn't roll cars onto the empty lot.
That would be correct. But also, every single house in Kutsky Park has asbestos and mold.
And if you own the house, you might want to knock it down, right?
Well, normally our action would be to require them to either fix it or demolish it. Mm-hmm. Under the statute, it's their choice.
This was done for the purpose of expanding a surface parking lot again. That's why it was done.
So we're gonna. I mean, how do you know what their intent was?
No surface parking.
Mr. Bilderback?
Did you follow up to see if this house was on the start list?
It's not. And the issue here is it's more just the...
Yeah, I understand,
okay,
but
you got
I knew you were checking. And I had
it's not on the start list. It didn't have historical significance.
Okay.
It was just a neighborhood
because
property.
There was a question whether it was done legally or not in building safety.
I don't believe this was on the start list.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Campion?
The Councilmember Wojcik, you're proposing a moratorium on, not on tearing down buildings, but on
correct.
Establishing new surface parking lots, correct?
Yes.
And I reached out to the zoning administrator to ask about changing the review process from in an R3 from a type 1 review for a surface parking lot to a type 2. So at a minimum, it would come before the council. I don't know if that would be something that would be more appealing to others, but I wanted to propose, you know, to at least throw out an additional option we have here. Yeah, you know, obviously, you see how these parking lots go up. They do really disrupt the neighborhood fabric in these areas to have a parking lot just crop up. But it is also sometimes that there's a legitimate reason if you're doing a redevelopment to also
right.
put up
yeah.
surface parking there.
Absolutely.
So I think, you know, maybe the zoning administrator could come up with some additional conceptual language or options for us here. I know there was... She didn't like my proposal, which is the luxury of being a council member is you get to lead the way sometimes and throw it out there to get everyone on board. But the other option really is to fully qualify what we expect from people doing those parking lots downtown. And at this point, we've been mysteriously unwilling, I think, to qualify what we think makes a legitimate reuse of a parking lot in a surface area inside one of these R3 core neighborhoods. If we continue to not want to do that, I think we should take them the onus to review them on a case-by-case basis or to, you know, or to ban them if that's what we want.
Okay, Mr. Bildebeck.
Michael, are you asking them planning to draft this letter?
They would do a better job than I would.
Okay, well, I'm just wanting to make sure that we know who's assigned.
Well, and what I would say is, if nothing else, I'll hope to bring it to a vote to at least initiate the work. But the key thing with the moratoriums are not intended to be forever.
Right.
What they're intended to be until we get something in place, and we have two things coming. We have the DMC the DMC guidelines, which is potentially a solution for this. And we also have, frankly, we've been sitting out there on a zoning overlay for the adopted Imagine Kutsky plan from more than 10 years ago that's just sitting there flailing right now, which could potentially be part of the comp plan update. But there are things out there that would dictate how these things can be done properly. There's just no weight to them right now. And my suspicion is the DMC design guidelines would weigh in very heavily in guiding this. And I don't know if you throw anything back at me on that. Or
I don't think that would preclude them from being placed there. That would have to be an ordinance amendment. Zoning ordinance amendment there.
That
would just deal with, you know, how they might look or
right,
how they would be
right.
designed.
Well, and that's potentially a solution, too, is dealing
right.
with how they look.
Right, but if you're looking to preclude them altogether, that would be the avenue to do that.
Mm-hmm. Mitzi, you had a comment?
I'm not sure you guys want to give me the floor, but I'm not in favor of adding more public review processes that end up being ambiguous. They create a lot of uncertainty, not just for neighborhoods and adjacent property owners, but also for developers and for the staff. And they create these cumbersome processes in which it's often unknown what influence is going to result in the decision. I much favor a process in which you identify the standards that are acceptable to allow something to happen and let the staff administer it to those standards at the staff level and not have to go through more public hearing processes or more public review processes. Alternatively, if there's a use that really ought not to be there, don't allow it, period. But I think there are solutions that don't involve more public review or protracted processes, and I would favor those.
All right. So it sounds like this topic will come forward for some
mm-hmm.
discussion at a council meeting. All right. Any other quick topics for this afternoon? Then we are adjourned. Thank you.
I like your
Yeah, she told me exactly that. See, you never ask a question.
I'll tell you your liability.